Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. As mentioned, I'm George Knapp, live in Las Vegas, most exciting city in the world, in my opinion. And we're talking with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. One brief note, Art Bell, by the way, who I'm filling in for tonight. Art Bell will be back on April 15th, and I'm sure all his loyal listeners can't wait for that. Back to Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. Bob, before the break, I had a question for you. You know, on your website for United Nuclear, you've got this little animated guy whose eyebrows move up and down, and the caption underneath of it is, "Got Uranium." And I know from speaking to you before that one of the products you first started selling online was uranium pellets that you'd go out and gather in the desert on public land. And I wonder, you know, what are you thinking? I mean, wouldn't you think that in post-9/11 world that you're going to attract some attention selling that?
Well, hang on. Let me make a correction first. What we sell is uranium ore, not uranium pellets. By saying uranium pellets, you made the hair stand up on the back of all the people from the NRC thinking these are reactor fuel pellets. They're not. What we sell is uranium ore among, you know, a wide variety of other scientific equipment, chemicals, and whatnot. And no, uranium ore is not a dangerous thing. You can't make a bomb out of it. Well, if you have gigantic quantities of it and the power of an entire city to process it and several years, yes, you can purify uranium. But selling little pieces of ore here and there for science experiments and experiments involving radiation or physics is completely harmless.
Who are your customers, though? I mean, I'm assuming you're not selling to Osama bin Laden, and that's not the reason that the government is looking at you. Who are your customers?
Actually, an increasing amount of our customers are federal agencies now, which is really strange. I was under the impression they wouldn't do any business with me, but I have been proven wrong that in two accounts. First of all, we wound up getting a government contract, and second of all, just an increasing number of government agencies from the military, specifically the Navy and the Army, and other government factions, like the Border Patrol, for instance, buys infrared flashlights from us. The Department of Naval Sea Warfare buys ultraviolet equipment and, you know, things of that sort. Fire departments throughout the United States, that's actually the most common customer of radioactive ore. And what the fire departments use it for is everybody's training for homeland security exercises. So they'll typically buy a piece of ore and maybe a piece of ore and a Geiger counter from us, and they'll hide it somewhere, and this way they can train the people that operate the equipment to try and find the radioactive ore with the Geiger counter, and they just use it in other drills and, you know, things of that sort. So we sell to a wide variety of schools and universities, too, and, of course, the general public.
NASA? Bob, wasn't NASA one of your customers?
Yeah, they were. I don't remember.
George, this isn't all for necessarily for uranium ore. They have a wide range of products we sell.
For listeners just joining us, we've been talking about the latest chapter in the Bob Lazar saga, a raid on his property in New Mexico by a host of agencies who seized records and equipment and things of that sort as part of a possible criminal investigation into his business, United Nuclear. Bob, we're going to, just to wrap up this part of the conversation, can you tell us where you think this case is headed? Is there a date? Is there a point on the calendar at which you're going to know something?
Well, no, there's no specific date yet. It's basically finding out, and we've hired attorneys to discuss this with them, exactly what do you want? What is the problem? What are you going to charge us with? What, you know, exactly, specifically, write down what the problem is. This could have all been taken care of if it's just something that we're selling or just a customer that we're dealing with or something. This could have been handled by a telephone call, but nothing in my wildest imagination would be reason to take the path that they've chosen. So, I don't know. It's kind of a wait and see.
Any word from your lawyer on his take on this thing or whether he thinks you'll be indicted?
No, nothing specific. I mean, it's anything's possible. It depends how hard they want to push on this and exactly what's the problem. Is it in fact that it's just some chemicals? Is it in, you know, the real problem customers were dealing with? It's something we need to find out.
Just another day in the life, I guess.
Yeah, it's not a fun day in the life.
Well, listen, I hate to take another break right now, but we're about to jump into the inevitable topic, UFOs, S4, all that stuff. You knew it was coming. But I think before we start that, we're going to get this break out of the way, and we'll be right back with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. I'm George Knapp, in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp in Las Vegas, filling in for Art Bell. Our guests, Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. And this is probably the part of the conversation that the audience wants to hear the most, but that Bob probably regrets speaking about the most. And I mean, all the stories that emanated from you starting back in 1989 about Area S4 and Area 51 and flying saucers and things of that sort. Gene, I wonder if I can impose upon you to sort of make a synopsis, a thumbnail sketch of this story as it unfolded, for the benefit of those listeners who may not be familiar with it.
That is an imposition, isn't it? Well, let's see. Bob would probably better just tell the story better than me, but I'll just say it so he can answer UFO questions. He moved to Las Vegas in the early 1980s and had some small businesses going and decided to get back into the scientific community. So he sent resumes out to a few places, and one of the guys he sent a resume out to was Dr. Edward Teller. Edward Teller is the father of the hydrogen bomb. Bob had met him when he worked at Los Alamos in the early 80s. Bob had built a little Honda with a jet engine in it, and the local newspaper in Los Alamos did a front-page story on him. Edward Teller coincidentally came to speak at Los Alamos on that very day, and when Bob was going over to the auditorium to listen to Teller's speech, lo and behold, Teller was sitting on a wall reading the new front page story about Bob's jet car, and Bob used that as an avenue to introduce himself to Edward Teller. And anyway, so back to the 80s now, Bob sends out resumes and gets a response from Edward Teller, gets an interview out at EG&G when it was located out on Sunset Road near McCarran Airport here in Las Vegas. Bob, how did it go from there? I forget how it went from
He gets hired into a program.
Yeah, hired in. They just said it was in propulsion systems. I don't know what he thought it would be, if he thought it would be jet propulsion or whatever in an outer area. And so then they flew him out to Area 51, and he went through, well, first he went through security checks. The Office of Personnel Management, who does the background checks on all these people, came to his friends and neighbors and, you know, mom and dad and everyone to check him out, as would happen with anyone getting a security clearance. And he was flown out to Area 51, and I think Bob should take it from there, because that's the great story of when he was taken down to S4 in the briefing room, reading the reports for the first time. Bob, why don't you take it?
S4 is a facility south of Groom Lake. It has its own dry lake bed down there. And you, Bob, you say, as I recall, the story was that there was a facility built into the mountainside, designed to sort of make it look like it was part of the mountain, but inside was a fairly amazing facility.
Yeah, it was a research facility that had hangar doors along the side of the mountain, and after going through all kinds of security checks and, like you said, of my background and whatnot, eventually they drove me down to S4, and initially they just had me reading briefings that contained just an amazing amount of information, but some pretty bizarre information.
Aliens, flying saucers.
Yeah, you got it. And I really didn't know what to make of it, and they were trying to get me caught up to speed as quickly as possible involving this project. And unbeknownst to me, the project was to back engineer the propulsion and power system of an alien spacecraft. And they eventually did show me the craft a short time. Oh, I think I'd only been there two or three times. And the instead of coming through the main entrance of the place, they brought me in through the hangar, and I saw one of the craft. And
eventually, you saw nine of them.
Right. Nine of them when all the hangar doors were open, the internal bay doors. And it was my job to do, at least be part of the team. Each aspect of the craft had its own group of people working on it, and they really compartmentalize everything that way, so nobody has the entire breadth of knowledge about the entire project. And like I said, basically I just was involved in the propulsion and power system of the craft. I worked with one other fellow, and I was only there for a short time. I didn't work there for years or anything along those lines. But let's see, boy, a life story is so hard for me to do. One thing leads to another. I wind up telling Gene and a few other friends because I work at odd hours of the morning and evening. And I wind up telling John Lear, Gene Huff, finally told my wife and another friend, Jim Taliani, what was going on.
And you went out into the desert and showed them?
Yeah, since I had the test flight times of the craft, I knew what time and where to go in the desert to look. So we finally did sneak out there one night and got to show these guys what I was working on and, went home. And as time went on, we managed to get caught doing that.
By the way, that's using sneak in the absolute loosest sense of the term. We went out there in an RV and sat out in the desert. Remember, this was 1989. Since then, George, after you did UFOs, the best evidence in 1990, of course, the little alien out at Rachel out there has become an international tourist stop. And there, there were tour buses going out there, but back then there was literally no one in the desert in the middle of the week. They tested on Wednesdays, and we went out there, and you could have heard a pin drop in the desert. I mean, it was a starry sky. Nothing else going except, of course, until that little light popped up over the mountain and started jumping around in the sky. And so now people go out there and look and see all kinds of things. And, they find the story hard to believe, but the difference between the desert outside Area 51 in late 88 and early 89 and in the early 1990s after you produced UFOs, the best evidence, was night and day.
Back in those days, people forget that, there are all kinds of people who have bad things to say about you, Bob. And I can tell, how much you like talking about this story.
Well, it's really, I just cannot believe the amount of people that come up with the strangest stories that involve me. It just amazes me. Some of these stories are just so ridiculous. I don't know why people pretend or feel obligated to tell their friends or other people that they know me when they don't. I mean, I think I've told you the story before. I was driving through Flagstaff from Las Vegas on the way to New Mexico, and I was listening to an AM talk show to keep me awake because it was late at night, and I hear something that sounded similar to the Art Bell show, but it wasn't. It was some conversation going on about UFOs, and I was just kind of popping around on the channel, and I heard my name mentioned, and here's a guy that's giving an interview to the radio host, telling him how he just had lunch or dinner with me, something like that, and how I confided him all these new facts and things like that. But, this kind of stuff goes on all the time about the most ridiculous stories, and look, you get most of the emails. Fortunately, I don't, and like this guy that just said I worked on the stealth fighter. Where do people pull this stuff out of? It's unreal.
George, my favorite part of this story is that people either say Bob Lazar never did anything, they didn't even graduate from high school, till, he did things far beyond what he said he did, and they saw him out there and they can vouch for it because they went all the places that not even Bob Lazar was allowed to go. And, you know, that's the funniest thing. Like the gentleman you had on before we came on here tonight says that, Bob, he said that you had a female supervisor. And I'd like to know when Eric Davis, was that his name? George?
Dr. Eric Davis, yes.
Yeah, and he said, I don't know when he did this, but he says he asked Bob's supervisor if Bob worked there. Well, how would he know if
worked
she
where?
Was
what supervisor?
Out at Area 51. He says you had a female supervisor. Well, how did he know she was Bob's supervisor before she checked to see if Bob worked there? You know, if she's got to check on a computer to see when and where he worked, then how did Eric Davis know that she was a supervisor, not to mention that Bob never, ever had a female supervisor at all, right?
Wait, was this a female supervisor when I was supposedly working on the F-117?
I don't know, but you know, this was the...
No, I think it's at the brothel.
Oh, okay.
I'm just joking with you. That's not the only version of this story. It's, you know, a lot of people, exactly what you're saying, Gene, a lot of people don't buy it at all. Bob was never out there. He doesn't have his degrees. He's not a scientist. His physics doesn't make sense. We don't believe him. And then on the other hand, you got people, yeah, he was out there, but he worked on this or he worked on that, and we've confirmed it. It's hard to reconcile the two stories, no?
Well, Bob always, you know, he prefaces when he starts to describe the heavy element, the propulsion system, everything. He goes, now look, current physics on Earth, we have no idea what gravity is. We don't have these heavy elements. We don't have this and this and this. And he prefaces it with this, gives an explanation, and then all of the other people go, wait a minute. We don't know what gravity is. We don't have these heavy elements on Earth. They repeat the exact same thing he said and act like they're being critical and bringing up something that the rest of us don't know.
Well, let me run this one by you, Bob, because I just got a copy of this today. A guy named Tim Ventura. Do you recognize that name?
Oh, yeah. That's a guy I spoke to three or four times. He, I don't know if it's him or if he's actually made a company, and he makes these little electrostatic propelled craft out of balsa wood and aluminum foil, these little models that demonstrate ion or electrostatic propulsion and lift off the table.
Well, he's written this report, and I'm sorry to spring this on you, about he says in 2003 he spoke a lot of times to you. He was building a relationship with you so he could eventually conduct an interview about Area 51, and that you talked about a lot of different things. He says, to his credit, he says, you know, if I had a UFO, I wanted to understand after my team of physicists gave up in despair because they couldn't fit the technology to existing physicists, I'd bring in people like Lazar who would ask interesting questions and get unique answers. He says that in 2003, you told him several times that your number one customer for Geiger counter equipment were Los Alamos and Sandia National Labs, that you had visited both of those labs. Your wife, girlfriend corroborated the story. And then the interesting part, in October 2003, you called him up and said you'd been doing contract work. This guy had been doing contract work at Telecommunication Systems in Seattle, and that a certain scientific team that you, Bob, were involved in had been scouring the web for material on lifters, stealing data from this guy. He seems to imply that you got really mysterious on him on behalf of government agencies, and that maybe you were working as an agent. Does this ring a bell?
All right.
So you're admitting it?
No. Okay. This is another typical example of it. Just an ordinary story that gets completely tweaked into another realm of existence. I contacted.
So,
well, go ahead.
I'll tell you what. I think we're not going to have time to finish the story. So when we come back from this break, we can talk about that. We'll also address the question of whether you're a disinformation agent, because that's a question a lot of people have. And we may even get to talk about a wild, wacky UFO guy named Dan Burrish. Stay tuned. I'm George Knapp, in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're speaking with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. My name is George Knapp, in for Art Bell. Right before the break, Bob, I was mentioning a guy named Tim Ventura, who wrote a very detailed report that appeared on the Internet today about his previous encounters with you. At the top of this report, it says, in late 2003, Bob Lazar recruited me to work on a top-secret propulsion project at Sandia National Labs that probably never existed. Lazar speaks believably, and if it wasn't for the story itself, I never would have questioned his veracity. 2 years later, I still don't have the answers, but I do have a lot of questions. What he says was, along the lines, after talking to you many times on the phone, that he was told that you were in Washington, D.C. You got back on the phone with him after returning from D.C. and said you'd been meeting with high-ranking officers about putting together a secret project to develop this prototype aircraft using technologies that have been found online in the open source community. So he wonders, was there a secret project at Sandia to develop such a craft? And what was your involvement with it? What's your version of this story?
Well, like I said, this is one of those typical stories that gets distorted into another realm of consciousness here. Basically, I've never met this guy, Tim Ventura. I spoke to him on the phone a few times, and basically, apparently, how this got started was me calling him. I knew of someone and met them. Now, who they were affiliated with was never all that clear. He did work for Sandia, and whether his project was government-funded or privately funded was never really clear. Anyway, what this guy was producing was an electrostatic lifting vehicle, and it was just a larger model. A Tim Ventura guy makes these little, I guess you would use them for science fair projects or something, little tabletop balsa wood and aluminum foil things. You apply high voltage to them, and they lift up. It's a demonstration of electrostatic propulsion, which is nothing new. This guy had a large-scale version of it and apparently was planning on making something much bigger, and anyway wanted to recruit me for consulting in the project. There's nothing secret or anything along those lines. However, he always made a big deal about keeping things quiet, about, you know, who I mentioned anything to. But as far as I know, there's nothing secret about this. A short time later, I had remembered seeing something just like that on the internet and kind of browsed around a while and found Tim Ventura's page and said, you know, boy, that thing looks exactly like what this guy is doing. Now, I called Tim Ventura, who I don't think I had spoken to ever before, and just mentioned to him that there were these other guys using his design or something along those lines, and they were interested in me consulting for him about producing a larger version of this or commercial applications, so on and so forth. And, you know, would you potentially be interested in it, considering that, you know, you've been tinkering with this stuff a hell of a lot longer than me. In fact, I wasn't even that knowledgeable about that particular field.
What about this part on the meeting with high-ranking officers in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I met with this guy and a couple of his buddies, and then mentioned Tim Ventura's name, and, you know, just waited for them to get back to me if this thing was ever going to materialize. You know, a lot of consulting jobs end up this way. Somebody calls, and then you just never hear back from them. But, you know, I mentioned Tim Ventura to them, and a short time later, they got back to me, and I think I got some more information from Tim, and all he said at the time was that he was working in a bank and was really bored with his job, if I recall correctly, and I think possibly doing some computer work or something.
Well, at least it sounds like there is some basis for what Tim is writing.
Oh, yeah, and then, like I said, but it's not a spectacular story or anything, and they got back to me just saying that it was apparently just incredibly underqualified for the job. I mean, apparently he didn't have any, similar work experience. This was just a hobby for him. And that was about it. And I countered with, well, boy, the guy's been tinkering with this stuff for years. He's got a website about it. And what you're making looks exactly like what this guy builds on a daily basis. Don't you guys think you should get together? And we kind of went back and forth. And I asked for more specifics on the project or potential project to give to Tim, who I was just, you know, trying to get an interesting job for. And never really got anything specific, and phone calls weren't returned.
And it kind of fizzled out.
Bob, it just kind of faded away, and that was that.
This type of propulsion system is also what a lot of people who know nothing about propulsion and especially know nothing about the cosmos think could be used to propel flying saucers, right?
Yeah, but
you know what I mean.
It's not. It's not any gravity or anything like that. It's just electrostatic propulsion. It's the same thing that keeps the little styrofoam peanut stuck to your hand. It's you can apply a high voltage to.
Isn't that how you used to fly those plates over your Tesla coil and the Van de Graaff generator?
Yeah, and the Van de Graaff. It's just, you know, repulsion of like charges and also an ion spray off a sharp point with high voltage on it. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can use electricity to, you know, lift things up. But for deep spacecraft, it is a form of propulsion. In fact, NASA's probes and the upcoming, I think, asteroid probe is going to use a type of ion propulsion. So, but as far as, you know, in the atmosphere flying around, no, this isn't something useful.
Well, I think the point that he was trying to make is that, you know, here you are traveling with shadowy guys and you had relationships with Sandia and working on exotic propulsion. You know, we've heard those kinds of conspiracy theories about you before, that you're a disinformation agent, that you helped the government to spread this whole story.
For what purpose? Why would what's a disinformation agent supposed to be taking your attention away from?
Well, I think people have said taking your attention away from something else that might have been out at 51 or S4, which my response to that has always been, boy, if this was the government's idea to take attention away from something else they had going out there, it was a miserable failure, because the result of your stories coming forward is that Area 51 became a household name. Tens of thousands of people have trekked out there over the years and still do to see whatever is flying around. The state of Nevada dedicated the ET highway that goes right past the base, and I'm sure the folks who run Area 51 are not very happy about this strategy. So if someone came up with it, it didn't work. A lot of folks believe, though, in their hearts that you were working for the government part and parcel, either as an active agent or as a patsy. That's one of the emails I saw yesterday. Somebody compared you to Lee Harvey Oswald. Not that you are dangerous, but that you are a patsy in the big picture. Any comment?
Oh, boy, how could I comment on
George,
that? These scenarios just sound ridiculous to me.
George, these scenarios go full circle. Does anyone ever offer any suggestions to you? I always ask them, what in the world could they be hiding that they would go through all this expense and time and trouble to, not to mention, not just the Bob Lazar story, they must be faking UFO sightings all around the world for the past 50 years, for the past millennia, according to, you know, all the historical sightings and everything. All this has been going on so they could hide what? What is it that's going on out there that they're using this as a front for?
Well, no, the question I have is why?
Well,
why would
I
create something like that? Look, I don't like giving interviews. I don't create lectures and get money from this. I don't do anything with it. I'm trying to divorce it as much as possible. It's something that I was involved in one point in my life and spoke about it, and that was that. I have better things to do. This has been an incredible source of aggravation for me. I don't seek public attention. I try and avoid being on the radio and unless somebody just drags me on.
like me, yeah.
You know, other than that, what in the world would you think? I have nothing better to do, and I really am extremely busy, and stuff like this just doesn't make any sense to me. Why in the world would I do that?
Well, there are some things that I know a lot of people don't believe your story, but there are some things that you knew and know that you could not have known otherwise that have been verified, and I'm going to go over that list of things when we come back in just a moment. We're going to take a short break, speaking with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. I'm George Knapp, in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. I'm George Knapp, in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. We're speaking with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff about S4 flying saucers and things that Mr. Lazar really doesn't want to talk about anymore. But we're sort of forcing him to do it anyway. Bob, when I am questioned by people who don't believe your story whatsoever, who believe you were never out there, that you made all this stuff up, and they point to, look, he can't prove that he went to MIT. He can't prove he went to Caltech. He can't prove he really worked at Los Alamos on any kind of sensitive projects, and he certainly can't prove he was out there at Area 51 or S4. I remember a couple of things that come to mind that suggest that you did, in fact, have these experiences, because they were things that you couldn't have known otherwise. The most obvious one is the fact that disc-shaped objects were flying around out there. You took people out to the desert a couple of times in a row to show them this. I've interviewed those witnesses. I've seen the videotape, something that looks very much like a flying saucer flying around in the exact area and at the exact time that you said it would fly around. So how could you have known when and where? You also knew about the OFI. That's the Office of Federal Investigation. I thought you made a mistake where you're talking about the FBI was the one that was doing a background check on you. But it turns out that you knew the name of the agent, Mike Thigpen, and you knew the existence of OFI, which I had never heard of. Both the Thigpen and the OFI check out. You knew about the designation called S4. To my knowledge, that had never been made public in the past. I was able to confirm that with Nellis Air Force Base, that it's a real place, although they would not confirm where it was. People forget that you also passed a polygraph test. We administered this test, a polygraph examiner named Terry Tavernetti, who still works for a major corporate firm here in Las Vegas, a former police officer, put you to the test and said you passed it with flying colors. I know you also had information about the base itself, the little tiny things like where the cafeteria was and how to get around in there. And then, of course, people forget about the difficulty that I had in getting your records. I mean, the song and dance I went through with Los Alamos to get very simple employment records with Los Alamos, plus with the company that had first recruited you to that job. The difficulty that Congressman Bill Bray's office had in getting very simple files from the FBI and others, it suggested to me that something really was going on. I mean, when this comes up, do you give that kind of litany of responses, you or Gene?
No, I don't. And believe it or not, I actually prefer that people don't believe it. And please, I will not be the one that tries to convince you, because if you think the story is ridiculous and don't believe it, please continue to believe that. In fact, tell other people that, because this way I get bothered less. But, this in fact did happen. But like I said, I hate the topic. I don't want to be involved with it anymore. And, you know, all these events did occur in my life, and I did do the things I said I did. And, you know, that's that. And, of course, if the shoe was on the other foot, I've said this before, I don't know if I would believe the story, because I can't present enough evidence. And, you know, being scientifically minded, that's what I go on. Yeah, there is some evidence here and there, but I can't physically bring people there. I don't have, you know, really that much physical evidence to produce, to put in front of somebody. So I'm not sure I would believe the story either, and you know, what can I say?
That's the bottom line, George, is, as you well know, when people ask for some support and you give them support, like you just said, well, here, everyone said he did work at Los Alamos. Here, I proved that he did. I've met people that worked there with him. You got his name there in the phone book. Eventually, you found out his Z number and that he actually did work at Los Alamos. You bring them along, you give them, then they go, okay, well, what about this? And you prove the next step. Well, what about this? And it's never ending. You never reach a point where they go, okay, I believe it now. They want you to be able to lay it out and prove it like you could in court. Well, if you could do that, you would be talking to them anyway. You know, each
right.
individual thinks it's our burden to prove it to them. And so, like Bob, I mean, I don't even try anymore. I mean, I know what I know. And you notice, look, as you pointed out before, this is 17 years later. Look, without Bob, since Bob got out of the program, I don't know any more about UFOs than the next guy does. I just know what happened with him back then, and I believe it because of the things he shared with me. But you can't prove it, and so why would we be trying 2 decades down the road?
Well, one of the things that recently caused this to all be stirred up again was the creation of a tiny portion of Element 115 by scientists. And, of course, this is what you said was the fuel for these alien craft. The scientific community around the world was able to create other elements around 115, and finally got a little bit of 115. But, you know, your supporters said, well, look, it really does exist. Your critics say, hey, this 115 isn't like anything like what Bob said it was like. It only lasted for microseconds. It's tiny little amounts. Lazar claims there was 500 pounds of this stuff up there. What help me understand why this the creation of 115 by our scientists, how it relates to your story. Does it add to it? Does it detract from it? And if it's not stable, as what you described, how do you explain that?
Well, both sides are actually correct to some degree. Yeah, it is something I said was possible and that the craft operated on and, you know, did in fact exist. And, you know, at the time it didn't. So, yeah, they did prove that it can be made and it does exist. However, it doesn't, what they created didn't have all the properties of the material that I described. And the reason for that is there are elements and different isotopes of those elements. To use hydrogen, for example, hydrogen has three isotopes. Hydrogen that we're familiar with, you can call protium. It's the typical hydrogen gas. Another form of hydrogen is deuterium, which is what heavy water is made from. Another form of hydrogen is tritium, and this is a radioactive gas, where the other two aren't. So each one of these has slightly different properties.
Because of what? More neutrons.
Yeah, it's the number of protons in an atom define what that atom is. For instance, an atom with one proton is hydrogen. An atom with, six.
Well, I won't put you on the spot.
I'm trying to remember now.
What's tritium?
Well, you know, 16 protons is oxygen. And as long as you have the same number of protons in the nucleus of the atom, if you add different numbers of neutrons to it, it still is that element, but it becomes a different isotope of that element and can have different properties. For instance, an ice cube made with deuterium oxide will sink in water.
So in other words, the version of 115 that's been synthesized, that was created by these scientists, maybe not just a good shot, good try for a first time.
It's certainly 115. It's certainly 115. They made four atoms of it, I believe, and detected them as they went through the detectors. But they also detected a rapid decay. But just like hydrogen has an isotope that undergoes radioactive decay, it also has stable isotopes. So, yeah, they simply didn't make the isotope of element 115 that we were dealing with. So I'm sure continued experimentation will reveal it. As long as they keep doing this, eventually they'll come up with a proper isotope, and it's going to have the properties that I claimed.
Am I correct in remembering it this way, but weren't you guys, the two of you, were contacted by this heavy ion research lab in I think it was in Germany, the same guys who are working on this thing?
Darmstadt, yeah.
Yeah, that
Darmstadt.
Was a long time ago. I hardly remember what that was about. But, yeah, at the time, I think they were trying to synthesize it. And
I thought they did. I thought they actually made an atom or two of it about 10 years ago, which is why I was surprised.
No, I think they made 1.7 now.
But the lesson is that they actually took you seriously on it.
Yeah, apparently so.
Okay, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff, and we'll be taking your questions, and we'll open up the phone lines. I'm George Knapp in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM.